Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. Since it's 5:01, we'll get started. Thank you for coming to Happy Hour. So what we're doing, I think you know, is the 2012 midterm exam. We'll use this as a springboard for discussion. So the aim is we'll go through each of the questions, and if you have any related questions along the way, or if we want to take a side question, we can do so. So the first scenario that actually covers questions 1 through 9 is looking at the relationship between arsenic caused skin lesions as exposure to drinking water and investigating its relationship to some other risk factors as well. So we see this table one is looking at some study variables, some demographics as well as clinical variables, and then two groups, individuals who have skin lesions, 108 people and 150 without skin lesions. And so we can see here, if we take it at a glance, we see the sample sizes in both groups. We see the percentage that are listed here, percentage of men and women that add to 100%, the percentage that are in the cigarette smoking categories, which also add to 100%. Cigarettes per day is mean, plus or minus standard deviation. Some percentages for chronic cough, yes, no, and then a severity score with mean and standard deviation. Okay, so the first question says, we could estimate the odds of chronic cough among individuals with skin lesions as what? So I've put the table here so we can look at it as well. So we have the group with skin lesions, 108 people. And if we looked at the chronic cough category, what we see here is that we have the percentage with chronic cough is 31% and without chronic cough is 69%. So we have to first say, what do we mean when we say odds of chronic cough? So it would mean the probability of chronic cough divided by the probability of not having chronic cough. And so we actually have those figures. It's 0.31 divided by 0.69. And if we got rid of the percentage points, it's the same as 31 out of 100 divided by 69 out of 100. So our answer here would be D, 31 divided by 69. Okay, so far so good. Moving on to number 2. So it says here, using the data from Table 1 to assess the association between arsenic-caused skin lesions and chronic cough, so two variables, what would we conclude? So it says calculate the most appropriate odds ratio and make the appropriate conclusion based on the 95% confidence interval that's associated in this response with your calculated odds ratio. So let us look at what the odds ratio would be. So this is saying we're looking at the odds, and we're just going to skim down the responses here and see that some of these are expressed in terms of odds of chronic cough. Some are expressed in terms of odds of arsenic-induced skin lesions. And it could be either one, couldn't it? Because we can talk about the odds of chronic cough in those with arsenic-induced skin lesions versus not. Or we could talk about the odds of arsenic-induced skin lesions in those with chronic cough versus not. So we think of it as a two-by-two table. In fact, we have it here. So in terms of that, so this table that we have is looking at skin lesions, no skin lesions, chronic cough, no, yes. So we really have these four cells to deal with. So let's look first at the odds ratio, which would say let's look at odds of chronic cough in those with skin lesions versus the odds of chronic cough in those without skin lesions. We'll start there. Okay, so what's the odds of chronic cough in those with skin lesions? We actually already said that. It's 31 over 69. Whereas the odds of chronic cough in the group without skin lesions is 12 over 88. So here's where we probably would want to take out our calculator and do a real quick, so we'll see if we all get the same thing. So I'm getting about 3.29, 3.3. Okay. And if we wanted to as well, since we happen to be looking at this table, should we look at the other one, the odds of the arsenic-induced skin lesions by chronic cough, just for fun? Yes, let's do it. Okay, odds of skin lesions. So I'm just going to call it skin, if you don't mind. Odds of skin lesions in those with chronic cough over the odds of skin lesions in the group without chronic cough. These are certainly two odds ratios that allow us to look at association between these two variables. Yes? Okay, so let's just look at what are the odds of skin lesions in the group that have chronic cough. So here's the group that has chronic cough. It's that row that says yes. So the odds of having skin lesions in that group, it looks like, is 31 divided by 12. Okay. And then what are the odds of skin lesions in the group without chronic cough? It looks like it's 69 divided by 88. Okay. And if we go through a little bit of math, what is that? It's actually algebraically the same. So it's 3.29. Okay. So we just did that for fun. Now let's go back and look. Let's go back and look at our answers. So the odds of chronic cough are statistically significantly increased in those with arsenic-induced skin lesions as compared to those with no skin lesions. Estimated odds ratio equals 3.2. I think that that odds ratio checks out in the way we formulated it. And now let's look at the associated confidence interval that we've been given and see if our conclusion is correct. So the confidence interval spans from 1.6 to 6.9, which would go along with saying it's statistically significantly increased. So I would say that that's true. We can go through each of them if you want. The odds of arsenic-induced skin lesions are statistically significantly increased in those without chronic cough as compared to those with chronic cough. What's wrong with this picture? It's switched. This would have been correct if it had said the odds of arsenic-induced skin lesions are statistically significantly increased in those with chronic cough as compared to those without. That would have made it correct. As it stands, it's false. The third one, there's no statistically significant difference in the odds of chronic cough by skin lesion status. Estimated odds ratio is 1.2. We didn't calculate that, did we? So that's false for that reason. D, there's a statistically significant difference in the odds of arsenic-induced skin lesions by chronic cough status. Odds ratio 1.2. Again, that's not what we calculated. And lastly, there's no statistically significant difference in the odds of chronic cough by skin lesion status. Odds ratio is 3.2, and that confidence interval does not go along with saying no statistically significant difference. Yes, Emily? No. So the fact is, this, although it says associated with your calculated odds ratio, we underlined this meaning take whatever confidence interval you were given and apply it to where you see the odds ratio given. So, you know, we were really meant to say, did we calculate the appropriate odds ratio? And based on the confidence interval that's given there, did we appropriately interpret it? Okay, so our answer would have been A. Yes. There is. We weren't expecting you to do it, but this is how we would. So the way we would have done it, we are going to talk more again about revisiting logistic regression, but I think most of you have taken EPI 1, most of you. And so what we would have done to get the 95% confidence interval is we would have taken the odds, it would have been two steps. We would have taken the log base E, of the odds ratio estimate plus or minus 1.96 times the standard error of the log of the odds ratio estimate, but the form that we would have used, but you weren't expected to at this point, was to take the four cells, 1 over A plus 1 over B plus 1 over C plus 1 over D, and then you would have gotten a lower limit and an upper limit. That the second step would have been exponentiating those to get the 95% confidence interval for the true odds ratio. We're not expecting this calculation on this exam, but that's how it would have been constructed. Okay? That's an FYI. FYI. Okay? Everything that we had was here. We just needed to make sure we, you know, correctly calculated the odds ratio. Okay, question? Yep. It does, yeah. So actually, this formula sheet, I understand what your question is. This formula sheet has this. So that's because this is also going to look like the final formula sheet. So what you'll see here, and this is a big FYI, you are not responsible for calculating confidence intervals for relative risk or odds ratio for this exam. This is for curiosity only at this moment in time. On this Friday. But what you're going to see is that we all are familiar with the relative risk estimate, and there's a corresponding formula that's for the relative risk estimate, the log of the relative risk estimate that's based on the N's, the Q's, and the P's. Yes? And the odds ratio estimate can also be formulated in terms of the N's, the Q's, and the P's, but it reduces down to one in the square root of 1 over A plus 1 over B plus 1 over C plus 1 over D. Okay? Stay tuned for more. Back. We'll go back. So I think we've done 1 and 2. Now we'll go on to 3. So 3 says, in question 3, X, Y, and X are binary variables. Y equals 1 if it's chronic cough, 0 if no chronic cough. X equals 1 if skin lesions and 0 if no skin lesions. And GLM stands for generalized linear model. Which of the following regressions would appropriately characterize the distribution of chronic cough and have coefficient beta 1 as with the interpretation? So it's saying beta 1 will be interpreted as the risk difference for chronic cough comparing those with and without skin lesions. So first of all, our outcome, we look right away, even before looking at the answers, we'd say, Y is a dichotomous outcome. So its distribution is going to have to be binomial. So anything that says family, meaning the family of distributions, that's Gaussian, is going to be incorrect. So we can strike through A, B, and E, because we know it has to be binomial. And then we have to remember, what is it? Which model is the one that will, which link is the one that will give us a risk difference? And so it's the identity link. So if we were looking at the probability that Y equals 1 equals beta naught plus beta 1 X, this is what is referred to by the identity link. So it's a lot, when we say identity, it is allowing us to actually interpret beta 1 as a risk difference. And when we say risk difference, let's look at that model to try to understand what we mean by that. So from the output, we're able to say that the probability that y equals 1, p, the probability that y equals 1, given x equals 1, is beta naught plus beta 1. And also from this interpretation of this model, the probability that y equals 1 when x is 0 is just equal to beta naught. So if we were to subtract these two things, what we would see is the beta naughts cancel out, and beta 1 by itself is a difference in the probability of the event occurring. In this case, the probability of cough, the risk of cough, in the group that has skin lesions minus the group that doesn't have skin lesions. Yes? Okay. But it's important to keep in mind that this is not linear in and of itself. This is coming as a back transformation from a logistic regression. But the link identity gives us, straight from the Stata output, gives us this beta 1 interpreted as a risk difference. So let's go through and see what we have here. C says, a GLM regressing Y onto X with family binomial and link equal to identity. I think that looks like the correct answer. Let's look at the next one. A GLM regressing Y onto X with family equals binomial and link equals logit. If it was logit, then what would be the interpretation of beta 1? Beta 1 would be a log odds ratio of chronic cough in those with skin lesions versus not. Thumbs up? So that is wrong. And what about F? A GLM regressing X onto Y with family equals binomial and link equals identity. It's not a regression of X onto Y. It's a regression of the dependent variable of Y onto X, right? So we're regressing chronic cough onto skin lesion when we get beta 1 as a risk difference for chronic cough comparing those with and without skin lesions. If F was correct, what would we be getting? If F was actually the model that was used, what would beta 1 be interpreted as? It would be the risk difference for skin lesions in those with chronic cough versus those without, right? We're just flipping the dependent and independent variables. Okay, I'll keep going unless somebody raises their hand like Charles. So, So the question was, what is it that we're, you know, sort of after? So I am going to just insert a slide here so we can think about this for a moment. So, you know, our goal with these generalized linear models is to be able to take an outcome variable, dependent or outcome variable Y, and find the link between Y and the X's, so one or more X's. And the way we want to link it is to always have what? A straight line relationship, right? We want to find a link between Y, some transformation of Y, that allows us to write beta naught plus beta 1, X1, and eventually all the way through beta P, XP when we continue with multivariable. So we want to be able to always have a straight line relationship on the right-hand side. So it's easy. When Y is continuous, then the link is to just take the expected value of Y, the average Y, equals beta naught plus beta 1, X1. And that link is just a straight identity link. The average Y equals the straight line. It gets a little bit more confusing, if you will, but it's only because when Y is dichotomous, is there any way that we could write Y equals beta naught plus beta 1, X1? Think of what it is. It's a 1 or a 0. So we just have a scatter of 1s and a scatter of 0s. We might have some darker areas. But we're not going to be able to express this as a straight line. So in the past, people have tried to do different transformations of this to find what might typically be a straight line relationship. And the one that is the winner, so what's the real winner? The log odds. So what we can say is that the log odds, where the odds is just the probability that Y equals 1 divided by the probability that Y equals 0, that's what we mean when we say log odds. That's what has typically been able to be expressed, and we'll have checks on this, but this is what can be expressed as a straight line relationship. But when we interpret beta 1 as a log odds ratio, the link that we're using is the one that says log odds equals beta naught plus beta 1 x. That's the link logit. Now, there is one slide, and we'll come back to this again, But if you looked in the notes and you saw if you can write the log of P over, what's the probability that Y equals zero? Q. But what is Q? Q is 1 minus P. If you can write the log of P over 1 minus P as this straight line, beta naught plus beta 1 X1, and I'll write it plus beta P XP, we can solve for P. It's just a little bit of algebra. So can I say dot, dot, dot if you do the algebra? You'll let me do that? What I would be doing is, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I would be exponentiating both sides. So I could write P over 1 minus P equals E to the beta naught plus this whole straight line relationship. And then I still need to solve for P, don't I? Eventually, after a little bit of algebra, I'd be able to say P equals E raised to this whole straight line relationship. You still all with me? Over what? 1 plus E raised to that whole same thing, beta naught plus beta 1 X1. So I'm just going to put a big rectangle around that. So it's really E raised to the straight line over 1 plus E raised to the straight line. So then if we know P, we know that Q is 1 minus that. Or if we have group 1, then we can write P1, or group 2 will give us P2. So what is going on behind the scenes with Stata is that when you ask for link identity, it is going to do the logistic regression, but then it's going to solve for the P's, the proportions, which are the risk, and allow you to see P, P in one group, P1, and then the risk difference, P1 minus P2. Hoping that makes some sense. This relationship, P equals beta naught plus beta 1 X, is never going to be a straight line. But you get from the link identity, you get this expressed, this beta 1 expressed as a risk difference. So just if we went through an exercise, we would say, let's go back. If Y is continuous, then it's just the expected value of Y equals a straight line. It's just a link identity, and we interpret beta 1 as a change in expected Y per unit change in X. If Y is dichotomous, typically we'd have a link logit in which we would say the beta 1, et cetera, are log odds ratios. The only other possibility right now is if it was a link identity, then our interpretation of the beta 1 is as a P1 hat minus P2 hat, in other words, a risk difference. Okay? This is really what we have right now in terms of these three different scenarios. So I'm going to go on to four and look at a test of the null hypothesis of no difference in the proportion ever smoking by skin lesion status is given by what? So you have table one on your first page. I've made it in very diminutive form here on this slide, but you can see we have the skin lesion group and the no skin lesion group. And if we look at the proportion ever smoking, it's 0.39 or 39% in one group and 0.38 or 38% in the other group. And our goal is to test a null hypothesis that P1 equals P2, the proportion ever smoking is the same. That certainly is the same as a null hypothesis that P1 minus P2 equals zero. And so in our hypothesis test, we set up a Z statistic that takes the difference in those two sample proportions minus the hypothesized value of zero, and we divide by a standard error of the difference in sample proportions that's based on what? Right, it's based on assuming the null hypothesis is true, so it's going to be using the pooled P, P bar Q bar over N1 plus P bar Q bar over N2. So we're just going to look and say we're really taking a weighted average of something that's 0.39 and something that's 0.38. So it's going to have to be a value that's in between. So without calculating it, we could see that A doesn't look quite right for a lot of reasons. What reasons doesn't it look right for? So first of all, it's using different proportions, and it's taking all of these over some summed total. This is just wrong, 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 wrong. B looks like it has some value between 0.38 and 0.39, so it looks like P bar is 0.384 and Q bar would be 0.616. B is looking pretty good. Let's keep ruling them out. What's the matter with C? It's everything's wrong. Is it using the right, is it using the right sample size in each of these two groups? No. So this doesn't look right. D, wow, where'd this come from? Okay. And E, same thing. You know, it's looking at some different proportion. In fact, you know, I'd have to scrounge around to see what proportion that might be. So in any case, it looks like, you know, this is correct. It's taking the difference in the two proportions in the numerator, and then the denominator is looking at the square root of P bar Q bar over N1 plus P bar Q bar over N2. Yes. So the reason why it's pooled, and maybe the best thing is to remind us that we're really relying on the sampling distribution, our knowledge of the sampling distribution. So if we think about what we're doing when we set up a hypothesis test, we're setting up a hypothesis that's going to be based on the sampling distribution of the difference in sample proportions. But our hypothesis is that P1 minus P2 equals zero, which is another way of saying our null hypothesis is that P1 equals P2 equals some common P. And if the P's are the same, what does that also mean about the Q's? It means we're assuming the Q's are the same. And then let's just talk about the, so if the mean of the sampling distribution is centered at zero because we're assuming that P1 minus P2 is equal to zero, the standard error, which theoretically is P1 Q1 over N1 plus P2 Q2 over N2, since the P's and Q's are related, when we look at that standard error, our assumption still is that the P's are the same and the Q's are the same in the two groups. So let's just write this as PQ over N1 plus PQ over N2. And when we set up that Z statistic, that standard error based on the sampling distribution, under the assumption that the null is true, is the square root of P bar Q bar over N1 plus P bar Q bar over N2. We all come back to the sampling distribution because we're basically asking this question. How likely is it that we would see a difference between 0.39 and 0.38 if the truth was zero? And we're assuming the truth, the difference is zero. And if we're assuming the difference is zero, we are assuming the standard error is based on P's and Q's that are the same. That's why we're pooling. We don't assume anything when we calculate the confidence interval. Okay, onward. Five, which of the following correctly estimates the intercept? Intercept means the constant or beta naught in a logistic regression of smoking status, so y equals 1 if ever smoked, and y equals 0 otherwise, on skin lesion status, x equals 1 if skin lesion present, and x equals 0 otherwise. So now the x equals 1 is skin lesions, x equals 0 is no skin lesions. The outcome of ever smoking, so means that y equals 1 for ever smoking, y equals 0 for never, and these are the data that we're looking at. The model is log odds of smoking equals beta naught plus beta 1 times x, and we're asked, well, how do we interpret or calculate beta naught? So we get at beta naught when x is equal to 0, and when x is equal to 0, that means we're looking at the no skin lesions group. So we would say, what's the log odds of smoking, you know, in the group with no skin lesions? No skin lesions, that's what beta naught will be. So what are the odds of What are the odds of smoking in that group with no skin lesions? The odds of smoking are 38 divided by 62. So what would the log odds be? The log of that number. The log of that number. So we need to solve, in order to estimate the intercept, we need to say the odds are 38 over 62. Are you all with me? And then we have to actually take the log of that. So you can't do this without your calculator, unless you're really good. I need my calculator. I get very upset when I lose this. Anyway, so what did you get? So I'm getting about negative 0.49. And that looks, does it look like that's one of the options? So it's E. So ask a question if you have a question, but what I've tried to point out is that when X is equal to 0, X equals 0 means we're looking at the group with no skin lesions, the odds of not smoking in that group is 38 over 62. We take the natural log to get beta naught. Yeah? Make sense? Go on. Should I ask another question about this question? How would you estimate beta 1? Okay, so beta 1, so we know that if X was equal to 1, that would be the group with skin lesions, and then beta naught plus beta 1 would be the log odds of smoking, meaning the log of 39 over 61 in that group. But beta 1 by itself would be the difference in log odds, which is the log odds ratio, if you were asked that question. You're not, but if you were asked that question, that is what it would be. Okay, we're going to keep going then. Thought that was just fun. So, 6, if a one-way analysis of variance was performed to assess differences in mean bronchiectasis severity score by skin lesion group, a potential major criticism of the use of this method is what? So we're going to go back and look at that severity score. Here it is. We only have two groups. Can we do an ANOVA with two groups? Sure. It's the same as a two-sample t-test with something. So here's two groups. We see the mean scores, 3.4 in the group with skin lesions and a standard deviation of 3.6. The no skin lesions, the mean is 0.9 and the standard deviation is 1.6. So when we think ANOVA, big assumption is equal variance across all the groups, equal variance. So we eyeball this. Standard deviation of 3.6, standard deviation of 1.6, the variability is twice as high in the skin lesion group as it is in the no skin lesion group. So it seems like that might be a possible problem. So here's our answers. The one-way analysis of variance can only be used for three or more groups. That's false. You can use it for two, but you don't need to. The severity scores are independent across all groups. Remember what the question was, a potential major criticism of the use of this method. Would it be a major criticism that the severity scores are independent? No. That is something that we assume. That's not and these are independent. The one-way analysis of variance cannot be used for cross-group comparisons of continuous variable distributions. ANOVA does need continuous, so this is not wrong. The between-group variance equals zero. Well, we don't know this, but that wouldn't be if the between group variance was equal to zero, that would just suggest that the means were the same. So that's not it. The within group variance differs considerably across groups. That's what we saw. That would be the major criticism, to use an ANOVA in which we pool variances across groups to estimate the common variance. In this, the eyeballs would say these are not equal. Okay, number 7 says, if a one-way analysis of variance was performed to assess differences in that mean severity score by skin lesion group, the mean square within groups would equal what? So the mean square for within groups remember, is taking out the variability that's due to between group differences. And if we had just two groups, what it's doing is trying to estimate the within group variability. So if you only have two groups, is the mean square within group. Now, what is the mean square? The mean square is the sums of squares for within groups divided by n minus what? N minus p. Okay, how many groups, how many p's are there here? There's two. Okay, so what we would, let's just say it's the degrees of freedom. Okay, so, but would it be equal to, let's start with e, the total sums of squares divided by n minus 1? No, because that's equal to s squared. That's false. The standard error of the difference in means assuming unequal variances in the two groups. This question is saying we're using an ANOVA. ANOVA says we're assuming equal variance. So this is false. The within group sums of squares multiplied by n minus 2, so the SSW multiplied by n minus 2, that is not what the MSW is. The MSW is divided by n minus 2. The between group sums of squares divided by 1, so for that would not be giving us this within group variability. So answer A is the answer, the pooled variance SP squared. So if you have two groups and you're assuming equal variance, then the pooled variance is what you're using as your estimate of the common variance. If you have ANOVA, then the MSW is your estimate of the within group variance. If you only have two groups, then if you performed an ANOVA, the MSW should be the same as the pooled variance that you would get when you perform a two sample t-test, assuming equal variance. Okay. Moving on. 8. Individuals with chronic cough were asked to undergo a CT scan for evaluation of bronchiectasis. A severity score ranging from 0, no disease, to 24, cystic disease in each of 6 lobes of the lungs, was graded independently by 2 readers. The correlation coefficient between scores of the 2 readers was 0.69. So what we can imagine is we have reader 2, and we have reader 1, so I'm drawing just a plot where, say, reader 2 scores on the y-axis, reader 1 is on the x-axis, and this scale ranged from 0 to 24. Okay, so we're told that in this assessment of the two graders, the correlation coefficient was equal to 0.69. So, first of all, we don't see a negative sign there, so that's a positive sign, indicating a positive correlation. And the 0.69, what is that telling us? So it's saying it's pretty strong that most of the points are hovering around the straight line relationship. If this had been a correlation of 0.06 instead, we would have seen a lot more scatter about that line. So this is a pretty strong correlation given by 0.69. So, A, there's a moderately strong increasing, meaning positively increasing linear association between the two grader scores. I think that's looking good. There's a moderately strong decreasing linear association. That would only be if the sign of the correlation coefficient was negative, so that's false. There's a negligible association between the two grader score. That would only be if R was sort of close to zero, so that's false. There is a 0.69 increase in greater 1 score for each 1-point increase in greater 2 score. What does that sound like? That sounds like a slope. And we know that the correlation coefficient R is not equal to the slope, only in special circumstances. Okay, so that's a false interpretation. We have 69% confidence that greater two score causes greater one score. What? Okay. So that one we could cross off right away. Okay, questions 9 through 11 are general knowledge questions about simple linear regression, SLR, and ANOVA. So it says, question? So in the simple linear regression model where y equals the fit, beta naught plus beta 1 x, plus the error term, where these errors are independent, normally distributed around 0 with variance sigma squared, the interpretation of beta 1 is what? So another way of writing this model is the expected y or average y equals beta naught plus beta 1 times x. It's just this. So the difference between this is we can either say that our points that are reflecting y versus x consist of the fit plus an error term. So each particular y is differing from the projected value or predicted value in that straight line by the error term. Or when we write expected y, we're saying for a given x, where's the expected y? It's the predicted or the fitted value, right? So let's look at this as expected y, average y, equals beta naught plus beta 1 times x. So maybe just for fun, we'll say, let's interpret each of these. So the expected y when x equals 0 is just beta naught. So if I asked you what's beta naught, which is not what this question is asking you, but if I did, you would say it's the average y when x equals 0. If we looked at the expected y when x equals 1, we would say that this is beta naught plus beta 1 times 1. So it's just beta naught plus beta 1. So by subtracting these, we know that beta 1 is a difference in the average y associated with a 1-unit increase in x. And we could see that if we had looked at any difference between, if I wrote, what's the expected y when x equals 2? That would be beta naught plus 2 beta 1. So beta 1 is the difference in the average y associated with each 1-unit increase in x. Yes? Yes. It is. Really, it is. Yeah. It's slope. So it's just what you learned in sixth grade when you were talking about the change in y per unit change in x. So let's start at E again. The average y for persons whose x is increased by 1 unit, it's not the average y, it's the change in average y, so that's false. The average y for persons whose x is 0, well, that would have been beta naught, so that's false. The average x for persons whose y is 0, not what we're looking for. The change in average x per unit change in y, if we switched our model here to say the expected y equals beta naught plus beta 1 x, expected x equals beta naught plus beta 1 y, that might work. So it looks like we're happy with it's the change in the expected y per unit change in x. That would be A. How are we doing? You want to stand up and shake a little bit or anything? No. Okay. Good. We won't shake. Number 10. What is the difference between an odds ratio and a relative risk? So I think that before I would look at the questions, the responses, I'd probably ask myself this question. I might even look at the answer at the formula sheet, because the formula sheet might be something to sort of look at when you're studying. So let's look all around that formula sheet. Ooh, okay. So on the formula sheet, page 1, we see the relative risk and we see the odds ratio, just to reaffirm our knowledge. Okay, so we know the relative risk is literally the ratio of risk in two groups. The odds ratio is the ratio of the odds in two groups. So we go back to number 10, and we try to answer the question. So for number 10, a relative risk compares two groups, whereas an odds ratio compares P and Q within a single group. That's false. What compares P and Q within a single group? That's the odds. That's just the odds, right? A relative risk compares P and Q within a single group, whereas an odds ratio compares two groups. Totally false. C, if groups 1 and 2 have probabilities P1 and P2 of an event, the relative risk is P1 over P2, whereas the odds ratio is P1 over divided by 1 minus P1, also known as Q1, divided by P2 divided by 1 minus P2. That looks good. If groups 1 and 2 have probabilities P1 and P2 of an event, the relative risk is P1 minus P2. That's the risk, that's the absolute risk or risk difference, whereas the odds ratio is the odds ratio. So this is wrong because relative risk is not the same as absolute risk. And then E, there's no difference between an odds ratio and a relative risk. These are two terms for the same thing. False. 11. In an ANOVA, what is indicated by an F test substantially larger than 1? So in the F test, we were looking at the mean square for between groups divided by the mean square for within. So conceptually, if the variability within groups is pretty much the same as the variability between groups, that's suggesting that the means are roughly the same. So when it's substantially different from 1, then the variability that we see between groups is much more than the variability within groups, and we would say that that suggests that at least one of the means is different. Okay. So let's look at, let's start at E. So E says, the sum of square deviations of observations from their means within groups is substantially larger than the sum of square deviations of the means from the grand mean, suggesting that the sample is too large to reject the hypothesis of equal means. Let's just tease that apart. That's a lot of English words. We're going to tease it apart. Okay, so when we're talking about the sum of square deviations of observations from their means within groups, this is the within group sums of squares. And so the sums of squares within groups divided by its degrees of freedom is what is the mean square for within. And if that is substantially larger, this is what E is saying, then the sums of square differences of the means in a particular group from the grand mean, that's what we're talking about when we have the sums of squares between groups divided by its degrees of freedom. That's the mean square for between. So if the denominator is larger than the numerator, then it suggests the sample is too large to reject the hypothesis of equal means. So what we did was we at least tried to translate what the first part of that was about. But then let's think what this is saying. The sample is too large to reject the hypothesis of equal means. It has nothing to do with it, right? The sample size has nothing to do with the F statistic comparison. So we'll say this is not what we're looking for. D, the sums of square deviations of the means from the grand mean is substantially greater than the sum of the square deviations of observations from their means within groups, suggesting that the sample is not large enough to reject the null hypothesis. So again, that wording about sample not large enough to do something is just not what we're doing when we're interpreting this ratio in the F statistic. The variation in observations within groups is substantially greater than the variation of means between groups, suggesting that a hypothesis of equal means should not be rejected. So the variation in observations within groups is substantially greater than the variation of means between. That would give us an F statistic, which is what? Much smaller than 1. And so that's not what we're looking for. We're looking at 1 being substantially larger than 1, much bigger between group variability than within. The variation in means between groups is substantially greater than the variation of observations within groups, suggesting a hypothesis of equal means should be rejected. B is what we're looking for. What does A say? There's a large difference in the variance between groups, suggesting that some other method than analysis of variance should be used. Charles. That's right. So, you know, we know that we're being loose here. The question was, you know, what is this about this comparison to one? So we're not using one itself. We're actually making this comparison of the observed F and asking how does it compare to an F that's tabulated with an alpha of 0.05 and degrees of freedom 1 and degrees of freedom 2, where the first degrees of freedom go along with the mean square for between, and the second go along with the mean square for within. But that comparison to that tabled F is not what we're looking up. There are pages and pages of those tabled F values. We're letting Stata just give us the p-value instead of making our comparison to the tabled F. So I'd encourage all of you, if you're curious about this, you know, either look in the back of your statistics book that has some F tables, or Google F tables. F tables. And you'll see when you Google F tables that it will come up with pages and pages of F tables with different degrees of freedom that correspond to all these possibilities. So we're just like we had all of those pages and pages of, well, we could have had pages and pages of T-tables, but we mainly had one page of t-tables, t-statistics, and tabled values of z, pages and pages. There are pages and pages of the f. So we're really saying how big is big depends on the degrees of freedom, but Stata will give us the p-value. You all okay with that? Okay. So here's an example. When we look at scenarios for 12 through 16, we have here an F statistic that went along with a simple linear regression, but why don't we come back and talk about those degrees of freedom and how it corresponds to making a comparison with a tabled value. But let's first see what the scenario is. So here we have a simple linear regression of a continuous outcome defined by arm circumference in centimeters on a covariate defined by age, continuous covariate in months for some of the Nepalese children. We're regressing arm circumference onto age. And this is what kind of a model? I know you told me I just read that, right? So it can be a generalized linear model that has a continuous outcome. So we can either use this special regress command to get the model, which would be the expected y equals beta naught plus beta 1 times x, where x is age, or, we don't see it here, but why don't we just say what it would have been? We could have said GLM, arm circumference, as the y variable, age. So we can use this umbrella command of GLM, it could have been used, but we would have had to say, what's the family? The family is normal or Gaussian because we have this continuous y of arm circumference, and the link will just be identity. Either one of these, the special simple linear regression command for regress, regress means continuous y and linear regression, or GLM, will give us the coefficients that we see here. So do you want me to spend a moment just talking about everything on this output? No, you don't. Okay. I guess you really don't. If you really don't, then I won't. Just a few minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so what are we doing? We're splitting the total variability in arm circumference, our y. So the total variability in that y about its mean, it would have been given originally. That whole variability in arm circumference about its mean, we could have calculated our sample variance by taking the SST over n minus 1. Now what we're doing is we're splitting the total variability into two sources. So the total variability was just the numerator that we used to use for the sample variance. We're splitting it into the sums of squares due to the regression model plus the residual, which we also call the error, right? We're splitting it into two components. And in English, we'd say some of that variability in arm circumference is due to the fact that as a child ages, their arm circumference increases. So we want to know how much of that total variability in arm circumference about its mean is actually due to this linear relationship or can be explained by the linear relationship with X, the age. So if it was a perfect prediction, and I always try to spend not too much more time on this, but I would just want to make sure that if it's a perfect prediction, if arm circumference could be perfectly predicted by age, then what would be true in this ANOVA table for the regression? The SSE would be equal to zero. SSE would be equal to zero. So what we see now is that out of the SST, some of it is explained by the model. We still have a lot of leftover of error or residual. We're splitting apart the degrees of freedom. We have one degree of freedom for the model because we have one covariate. And then we have a mean square that's always taking the sum of square divided by its degrees of freedom. And you can think of that as the average variability due to that source, right? Due to that source. So we have the mean square for regression. We have the mean square for error. We also have our old friend, the sample variance here, which is just the SST over N minus 1. And then we can look at the F statistic that takes the mean square for regression over the mean square for error. And we're really asking the question, is there more variability explained by the regression than what's not explained due to the model versus unexplained? And we see when we look at that, that F ratio is pretty big, 824. But how big is big? It depends. It depends on the degrees of freedom, which were 1 and 3,480. But Stata compares it to that and says the p-value is actually pretty close to zero. For all practical purposes, it's zero. So this is testing a null hypothesis that beta 1, the slope between arm circumference and age, is equal to zero. Yeah? Right? We'd reject this. What's the matter? Safiano, what's the matter? No? Okay. The null hypothesis is that beta 1 equals 0. The other way to do that is through the t-test, because we know these coefficients are B1 is the age coefficient, which is 0.035. B0 is the intercept. We have some inferences we can do with t-tests and confidence intervals. Okay. I can spend more time on them if you want, but I think you want me to go on to 12. Which I will. So the appropriate specification of this model, we just did this. Is it a log odds? No. What do we say? The Y variable was arm circumference, so it will never be a log odds. That's for a dichotomous outcome. So we're left with the expected arm circumference, which is the model we talked about, equals beta naught plus beta 1 age. The next one is the expected age equals beta naught plus beta 1 arm circumference. We could do that, but that's not the model that we specified here. We're regressing the Y variable onto the X variable. If we had done D, the command would have been regress age as the Y variable onto arm circumference as the X variable. Could have done that. Okay. And E? No, not. E is just a mixture of too many wrong things. 13. The 95% confidence interval for age, child. So this is really for the coefficient for age, child. The 95% confidence interval is 0.033 up to 0.038. And we saw it, didn't we? It's estimated as 0.0358. Here's the confidence interval for the true beta 1 in the population. How do we interpret this? So before we even look at the responses, we'd say we're 95% confident that this interval overlaps the true change in expected arm circumference with change in age. So A, the interval from 0.033 centimeters per month to 0.038 centimeters per month excludes the true change with probability 0.05. We don't know that. This is false. We don't know that it excludes the true change. The interval from 0.033 to 0.038 includes the sample regression coefficient with probability 0.95. It actually includes it with probability 1, because it's the middle of that interval. We're 95% confident that the interval ranging from 0.033 to 0.038 contains the estimated change in average arm circumference with unit change in age. So again, the estimated change in arm circumference with age is B1. That interval is formed by taking B1 plus or minus the tabled T value times the standard error. So we're 100% confident that it's in there because it's the middle of that interval. So this is false. Yes? Margaret? So if I asked you to calculate a confidence interval by taking B1 plus or minus the tabled T times the standard error, and I asked you, how confident are you that B1 is in that interval? You would be 100% confident. You'd be 100% confident. That's what C is talking about. So that's false. It's not 95%. 0.033 to 0.038 is an interval that excludes the true change in average arm circumference with unit change in age with 95% confidence. That is false. What we're looking for is we're 95% confident that this interval contains the true change, contains or overlaps the true change. The answer is E. 14. Okay, so the expected arm circumference for a 2-year-old child is what? So we're going to go back and say, what was our model? Our model was the expected Y equals beta naught plus beta 1 times age. And actually, what was Y? Arm circumference. And our model says the predicted Y equals B naught from the data plus B1 times age. We're just going to go back and we're going to review that scenario because that's always a good thing to do, to say that arm circumference is measured in centimeters and age is measured in months. And so we're asked, what's the expected arm circumference for a 2-year-old child? And a 2-year-old child is a 24-month child. So watch your units. Watch the units. Okay, so if we watch those units, we're going to say our prediction is going to be pretty easy here. We have to get the intercept. The intercept was 12.5, and the slope was about 0.036 times 24. Go through a little bit of calculation. So what do you get? So you got about 13.4 or 13.36, and the units of arm circumference are centimeters. Okay, we're doing really well, scoring 75%. So 15, that's because we're not done yet. Suppose that the simple linear regression was rerun using a variable derived by centering age at its median of 36 months, such that X equals age minus 36. So we're really just saying the expected arm circumference equals beta naught plus beta 1 times X minus 36. So this question is asking what changes in terms of the intercept and the slope. So A, the estimated intercept and the estimated slope will remain the same. False, because the estimated intercept will change. The estimated intercept is now going to be the expected arm circumference when a child is 36 months of age. Okay. B, the estimated intercept will remain the same and the slope will increase. False. Slope stays the same. So I don't know if you want me to go through this or not, but arm circumference is Y, age was X. We have this relationship. The original line said B naught was the expected arm circumference when a child was zero. Now we have a new X minus 36. So now if you use this new centered variable, what is the intercept? The intercept, which is now zero when age is 36, this is the new intercept, It's the expected arm circumference when an infant is 36 months. So, C, the estimated intercept will increase, and the estimated slope will increase. The slope doesn't change at all. It remains the same. The estimated intercept will decrease, and the estimated slope will decrease. The slope doesn't change. The estimated intercept will increase, because it's now the expected arm circumference for an older child, and the estimated slope will remain the same. So the answer is E. So if the slope was negative, so if we had a different question, but this was very specific to this problem, but we could think about that. If you had a decreasing slope, say you had y versus x, and there was a decreasing slope, and if you centered that, what you would see is that then the intercept would decrease. I agree. So if this was 36, so, but what we know from this example was we have the same data, and we're being told to rerun what we see here where there was a positive slope. And so that means that the intercept would increase. But you're exactly right that if we had a different relationship in which there was a negative slope to begin with, then if you centered, say, at 36 by taking x minus 36 as the new variable, then that intercept would have gone from a larger value and it would have decreased in magnitude. But that would only have been in a different situation. Okay, so 16 through 20 is the last scenario where it has an analysis of variance that compares the mean arm circumference among four groups of children. So here they are. The four groups are: zero reflects males less than 36 months. One is girls, females less than 36. Group two are males who are 36 plus months, and group three is males who are, let's do it again. Are you ready? Yes. Okay, so I'm going to say zero are boys under 36. One are girls under 36, two is boys 36 plus, and three is girls 36 plus. Okay, those are the four groups. And we say here one-way arm circumference group. So the outcome is this continuous arm circumference group is our categorical variable that we see here has, so group is just coded, it's just a label. 0 through 3 for the four groups. We're behind the comma, we see we're asking for the Bonferroni correction. And so the very first thing we would do is we would go to Bartlett's test. So we would test, we would look at Bartlett's test, which is testing that our assumption of equal variances in these four groups is the same. Right? The variance is the same in these four groups. And what do you conclude? P-value is 0.152, so fail to reject, conclude that this assumption of equal variance, equal spread in the four groups appears reasonable. So maybe we'll also look at the total sums of squares. We're splitting into the between group and the within group, but if we had run this as a regression model, what would we have called these? Just different. Right, so the between groups is really how much of the variability is explained by group. That would be the SSR for the regression, and the within group is the residual or the SSE, the error variability. So we can call them different things. They're really teasing apart the same factors. And so then we see the sums of squares, the degrees of freedom, the mean square, the F, and the F is taking the mean square for between over the mean square for within, like we talked about before. It's very large. P-value is zero. What's that testing? So it's really testing that all four means are the same, meaning they're equal to some common mu, versus an alternative, at least one of the means, one mu sub j is different. And so since we reject the null hypothesis of equal means, we're left with the question of which ones are different? Which ones? And we know we can see what they are from the output below. So which ones are different? Okay. So I would say looks like most of these are different because what are we comparing this p-value to? We're comparing it to 0.05 because this p-value that's given in the second entry has already taken the p-value times 4 choose 2, right? It's already a modified p-value. And we're able to then ask that question. So I'm going to actually write it that way, that this p-value, this entry, is already multiplying it by the number of comparisons, and we just ask, is that less than 0.05? If we did this by hand, we would have calculated the p-value, and we would have asked, is this, if by hand, so I'll write that down, if by hand, we would have said, is our calculated p-value less than 0.05 divided by the number of comparisons, which is 6, 4 choose 2 is 6. But Stata is being so kind and helpful that it's already multiplying the p-value by the number of comparisons so that all you need to do is compare it to 0.05. So what you'll see in the literature is if, like in lab exercise 3 or 2, whichever one it was, in the literature they may have a footnote that says we used a Bonferroni-adjusted, you know, comparison and that they report this as the adjusted p-value. You would just need to be clear. So what we have here are these are the adjusted p-values. They're already adjusted for the multiple comparisons. Okay, so in English, who are these groups? These groups are the 0, 1 through 3 are these different groups. So I think, Jad, you said, you know, the only one that's not different is comparing group 2 versus 3, which says that the average arm circumference in older girls and boys is not significantly different, right? So what are we observing? The difference in their average arm circumference is negative 0.12 centimeters. All of these other ones are much larger. Yes, Deborah. It is different. These are all different. So maybe we'll just go back and say that actually, when you compared the younger girls and boys, the difference in average arm circumference was negative 0.42, meaning girls. So, and let's say how do I know that this is saying that girls are less have lower average arm circumference than boys? How do I know that? How do I know that? Because it tells me here. It says row minus column mean. So the row, this is girls. Group 1 is girls less than 36. 0 is boys less than 36. So if I take row minus column, I'm having girls minus boys. So I know girls on average have an arm circumference that's 0.42 centimeters less than boys of that same age group. And then this p-value is already adjusted for the 6 possible pairwise comparisons. So this p-value we compare to 0.05, and we would say all of these are statistically significant differences except for the older girls and the older boys compared to each other. So that means boys versus girls of the same, less than 36, boys less than 36 versus boys 36 plus, girls less than 36 versus boys 36 plus, blah, blah, blah. All those other comparisons except for the older boys and girls. Yeah. Okay, but that was really good. So now we're going to say we could have done this. That's why I was emphasizing we could have done this with the regression model, because here it is. You don't have to say .xi in some of the later versions of Stata, because you can omit this. In Stata version 13, for instance, and 12, if you put I dot before a categorical variable, that says make indicator variables. So you don't have to make them for yourselves. Stata will do it for you. So make indicator variables based on the group. And we saw that group was coded 0 to 3. Stata says, okay, we're going to, by default, take 0 as the reference group. There are ways with Stata code to change this. And I realize every time I say that in front of a live audience like this, I can't remember what the code is. But you can look it up, and I will look it up, and I will make sure next time I can tell you what it is. But let's say it's the 0 code. 0 group is the reference. So if we looked at now splitting the total sums of squares into the regression plus the error, if you flip back and forth, what do you notice about the output? Aren't they identical? The ANOVA table is the same. What about the F statistic? F is 21.46 either way. Okay. So in the ANOVA output, we were very clear that the null hypothesis was that the means were the same. What's the null hypothesis for this F statistic? It's actually that all the betas, beta 1, not the intercept, but beta 1 and beta 2 and beta 3, that they're all equal to 0. So in order to interpret that, we have to ask ourselves, what is beta 1? Do you want to write out the model? This is totally up to you. Should we? No, nobody wants to write out the model? Then we'll talk about it. The model is, well, the model is this. The model is saying, I'm going to write it out. I'm not going to interpret it for you. I'm just going to write it out. The expected arm circumference equals beta naught plus beta 1 group 2 plus beta 2 group 3 plus beta 2 group, you know what? Since it was 0 to, would you like me to write it this way? Beta 1 group 1, beta 2 group 2, plus beta 3 group 3, and the reference group is 0. So if the dummy variables were all equal to 0, then beta naught is representing what? The average in group 0, the average arm circumference in group 0. And that's what this estimated B naught is, 13.5. That's the average arm circumference in boys less than 36 months. Okay. Then beta 1, I'm happy to write this out, but if you're happy just talking about it, I'm happy too. I'm happy if you're happy. Huh? If David says write it out, we have to have a majority rule, but do you want me to write it out?
Yeah.
Okay. We just want to insert a slide, new slide. Here we are. All that we're doing is writing the same thing that we could have done with an ANOVA in a regression model. So average arm circumference equals beta naught plus beta 1 group 1 plus beta 2 group 2 plus beta 3 group 3. We're going to do this so quickly and so together. So what we had were we had 4 groups. And the dummy variables that are being set up automatically, I'm going to call just group 1, group 2, group 3. And the way this was set up was group 1 was by definition equal to 1 only if they were in group 1. Group 2 was a 1 only if they were in group 2. And group 3 is a 1 only if they are in group 3. So then these are just wonderful dummy variables because when you look at them together, they tell you what group a child is in. Aren't they lovely? You're not finding that funny. Anyway, so this allows us to say that the average arm circumference for somebody who's in group 0, the dummy variables are all equal to 0, and beta naught, the average arm circumference for somebody who's in group 0 is just equal to beta naught. The average arm circumference for somebody who's in group 1 is going to be beta naught plus beta 1. The average arm circumference for somebody who's in group 2 is beta naught plus beta 2. And the average arm circumference for somebody who's in group 3 is beta naught plus beta 3. So we know right away, or pretty close to right away, that beta 1 is the difference in average arm circumference between group 1 and 0. Beta 2 is the difference in arm circumference between group 2 and 0. Beta 3 is between group 3 and 0. What's the difference between group 3 and group 2? Beta 3 minus beta 2. What about between group 3 and group 1? Beta 3 minus beta 1. So we're going to use the linear combination command in the future to talk about how to estimate those and get standard errors for them. But for right now, we know how to interpret those coefficients. So here's the issue. If this is arm circumference, and here we have these four groups, and if I had these listed as four different very looking different means, then for group zero, I would say beta naught is group one, is the mean for, sorry, beta naught is the mean for group zero. What's the mean for group one? It's beta naught plus beta one. For group two, it's beta naught plus beta two. I'm just trying to visualize this. And for group three, it's beta naught plus beta three. So what's the difference between group one and group two? Beta one. Between group one and group, between group two and group one, it's beta two. Between group three and group, I said that wrong, but you knew that, so that's okay. So between group three and group zero, it's beta three. But if the beta one, beta two, and beta three were all equal to zero, then what would this graph look like of means? If beta one was equal to zero, then all four of these groups would have a mean equal to beta zero, which means the means are the same. Which is why, when we go back and look at that F statistic, we're testing that the change in means between groups are all equal to zero, which is the same as saying the mean level is the same. Yeah? Okay, well then, we're done. So now, let's go and ask her a question. In the regression analysis above, we estimate the girls over 36 months have mean arm circumference equal to what? So girls over 36 months, they happen to be, if you recall, group 3. Okay, so how do we get group 3? We just did it. So the average arm circumference for girls who are greater than 36 months will be beta naught plus beta 3, and we have them estimated here. So I'm looking, it looks to me like it's 13.5 plus 0.5, so it's a little bit over 14 centimeters. Do you see anything that looks like that? Well, in fact, I see something that looks exactly like that because this is B naught plus B3. That's C. Do you want to know what these other things are? No? Okay. Okay, we're just going to do one. If I asked you, tell me what 13.54 is, you would say in English, it's the mean arm circumference for boys less than 36. This is B naught. And then we have some other stuff going on here, but, you know, we'll just forget that. 17. In the regression analysis above, the difference in arm circumference between girls 36 months, 36 plus months, and girls less than 36 months. So I think we can do that again because they were less than 36 months is group 2. Girls 36 plus months is group 3. So we're really asking, take the older minus the younger. So that's really group 3 minus group 2. That's right, because group zero was males less than 36. So if in doubt, go back and look. So I didn't do that, did I? That was a bad thing. Group zero is boys less than 36. Group one is girls less than 36. So we wanted to look at the difference between girls 36 plus, which is group three, minus girls less than 36, which is group one. So here we go. Group 3 is beta naught plus beta 3. Group 1 is beta naught plus beta 1. So we want to look at beta 3 minus beta 1. So we want to look at B3 minus B1, and that's some value. So we're going to take 0.53 minus 0.42. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Minus 0.42, because B1 by itself is minus, and we're going to get 0.95. I know that Margaret's been saying that over and over, but that's correct. 0.95. Where is it? Well, maybe it rounds to 0.96. So the answer would be D. Okay, 18. Based on these ANOVA results on page 7, what would you conclude? Where am I? Where is page 7? Yoo-hoo? Okay. Yes. That's a good thing. That's a good question. So the question was, why did I actually not just sort of save some efficiencies that I had some differences in means already here? The reason was I was sort of tied up with looking at the regression output, and I didn't realize that I actually had some added information available to me. So let's look at that added information. So I could have either taken B3 minus B1 that I get from the regression output, because I know that that's how I've defined these. Or I could have said, look at what we had from the ANOVA. Here it is. Shouldn't we just make sure it's the same exact thing? I'm happy to do that. So here we have the girls minus, so let's see where we would look. This is important to see where we would look. Which group is girls 36 plus? So girls 36 plus is here. Girls, which is group 3. Girls less than 36 months is group 1. So if I wanted older girls minus younger girls, so group 1 is girls less than 36. I could just look at this row minus column, so 3 minus 1, and I would see that that exact difference in means is 0.955. That rounds to about 0.96. So thank you for pointing that out. This is, you know, again, evidence that the output from the one-way ANOVA is congruent with the output from the regression, you know, the linear regression model that we set up with dummy variables. Okay, great. So 18 says, go back and look at the ANOVA. I think we already answered this question when we were looking at it. So what do the results say from this ANOVA? We'll just repeat what we know. Based on the F test, we reject the null hypothesis, and we basically had concluded that there were differences between the older girls and older boys. So 17, is that where we are? And 18, reject the null that the mean arm circumference is the same in all four groups, because I'm going to go with that F statistic, right? So it looks like we have a couple of places where the F statistic is cited here, but we're not going to fail to reject. The p-value was 0, so we're going to reject. I'll go with B, not D. And then we have some other things here. Let's talk about the chi-square test. The chi-square test was actually Bartlett's test. That was a test of equal variance. So I'm not going to worry about the chi-squared test because that's equal variance. And then there's another nonsensical one. Reject the null that the mean is the same in all four groups because R squared is 0.159. It has nothing to do with a test of means across groups. Two more, 19. Subsequent to the ANOVA, suppose that t-tests were performed to test the null hypothesis of no difference in means between groups I and J. And that's what we saw in the output from the Bonferroni. That's what we saw, but we only saw the difference in means. So in other words, we saw y dot 1 bar minus y dot 2 bar, and what else did we see? We saw an adjusted p-value in that output. That's all we saw when we saw those two entries in the Bonferroni. So now it's saying if you actually did that T statistic, you'd have the difference in means between, say, two groups, minus a hypothesized value, and it's asking what would really be the standard error that you would use in that T statistic. So would you assume the variances were different and keep them that way? Would you pool the variances from the two groups, I and J? Would you use one of these other three that takes the MSB over NI plus MSB over NJ or the MSW over the sample size? Or would you take the MSW over its degrees of freedom? And the question here is, what's your best estimate of the common variance across the four groups? And that best estimate is the MSW. So because of that, the answer to this is D. We're using the MSW, pooling information across four groups, even though we're comparing two. We're getting the most accurate estimate based on pooling across four groups. So the answer is D. Well, so what's the matter with B? Maybe somebody say, why is P not the best answer? Did I say P? Why is B not the best answer? B is saying take the pooled variance between the two groups and then take the square root of SP squared over NI plus SP squared over NJ. Why is that not the absolute best answer? Right, so it's going to be a better, more precise estimate of the common variance if we use the information from all four groups that we assume to have the same spread. So we're pooling from four groups instead of from two groups. So would B be absolutely incorrect? Not absolutely, but if you had to compare B to D, which is the best answer is D, and it is what is done after an ANOVA. And our grand finale, number 20. Suppose a desired overall significance level, assume a desired overall significance level of 0.05. So this is saying after you've done all the tests, you want alpha to be 0.05. Based upon the Bonferroni adjusted pairwise comparisons on the table in the previous page, and we've already done this. This is great. Isn't this easy? So if you interpret the table first, maybe all of the questions will become apparent. So, A, there's a statistically significant difference in mean arm circumference between every one of the six pairs of populations. False. There is a statistically significant difference in mean arm circumference between all of the six pairs of populations except boys and girls, 36 months. True. There is a statistically significant difference in mean arm circumference between all of the six pairs except boys and girls less than 36 months. False. There's a statistically significant difference in mean arm circumference only for the boys and girls less than 36. That's false. And lastly, there are no statistically significant differences, and that is false. So this is the end. So thanks for your attention, and have a good rest of the weekend.